Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Basketball News Podcast Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan, and joining me as always is my co-host, Steve Jones Jr. How are you doing, sir?
Feeling good, feeling great, happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, once again for embracing your bounce. So juiced to be here again. The hashtag is big time, folks. Nikias Duncan coming live from, where are you at, the suite?
There is no suite. I am in an undisclosed hotel in Miami at the moment.
54th floor. You just do low-key panoramic view. What you got?
I have a normal hotel room in a normal hotel.
Oh, that's just seeing 23-year-old me trying to sell the panoramic view. Anyways, different story for a different pod. First conference finals game in Miami. What a stretch for Nikias Duncan, folks, man. This man's turned this victory lap into a victory steeplechase.
What? Oh, man. No, it's been fun. Like last year, I was able to go to some of the Heat Bucks games in Atlanta. And so now to watch, you know, enjoy a Heat playoff game in person is a different experience. Younger me, very excited about what happened. The trained basketball eye watching that game from late third quarter onward was kind of like, what's going on here? But we will get into that shortly. But wild stretch, man. Wild stretch indeed. Very happy to be here.
I'm proud of you. I'm happy for you. I'm excited for you. You've put the work in. You deserve all of this. Also, man asked Bo three questions and I ain't got a text all day. So
what do you neither of those things are true. What do you Oh man, we've been chopping up trying to plan for this pod. You know, it's fine. At any rate, while I'm in Miami and while we're on the discussion of Miami, we can dig right into Heat Celtics game five, a game that was a tremendous defensive effort from both teams, at least within the first 34 minutes of the game. Just a back and forth affair. The Heat couldn't really find pockets. The Celtics couldn't really find pockets. Turnovers were back in the first half for the Celtics team. Miami was able to crash the offensive glass, create some extra possessions that way. And then things fell apart. Miami went small against Boston's double big unit. Miami were still able to generate some decent looks, missed all of them. Boston got out in transition, were able to get a run together. And then the fourth quarter just kind of snowballed. Next thing you know, Miami's down 20. It's like, well, that's a tad bit unfortunate. Props to Boston. Also, Miami ran out of gas. Also, who isn't hurting this series at this point? And I think that's probably the funniest portion of my night being in the arena and doing like the post-game stuff. And the first four or five questions were, hey, how are you dealing with ailment X? Eric Spoelstra, what kind of adjustments are you trying to make in light of all of your players being hurt, basically? And it's just the same. We're not making excuses. Boston won. Jimmy Butler, if I'm out there, I have to be better. Kyle Lowry, if I'm out there, I have to be better. Bam Adebayo, how are you going to carry the offensive load with your two co-stars hurt? Just put it on me. And on that front, listening to the crowd actively patronize Bam Adebayo when he had the ball in his hands in the second half was wild to me.
Well, I was going to ask because even through the television screen, you could hear early in the game when he would face up, there was like a light rumble. And then that, of course, got louder as the game went on. What was that like actually in the arena?
It was a stark experience. Like, one, props to the arena. Like, very heavy Heat presence, also very heavy Boston presence. Those fans travel. It was a full house before the game started, so you didn't get any of the Heat fans don't show up jokes or any of that stuff. It was a really good atmosphere in there. I really enjoyed it from that aspect. But yeah, the Bam stuff was stark. Like, we've had the aggression talks on the podcast, and that's a constant discussion in like Heat Twitter and stuff. But to actually hear it and feel the frustration from the fan base during live play, like, I don't have a whole bunch of in-the-house playoff experience, but, like, I've never experienced anything like that. That was stark. And Bam finished the game with 18. Granted, a lot of that came in the fourth quarter after Boston built that double-digit lead, but he had that stretch where he's taking Al Horford off the dribble, he's sprinkling in jumpers, he's getting to the rim, he's fighting on the offensive glass. Like, that's what the Heat fan base and I think the Heat want to see from Bam from open to tip on, and we saw that in game three. But yeah, it was a tough thing to listen to and feel. I was like, wow, this is a real thing.
I didn't know we were going to start with the Bam stuff. But since we're here, I might as well say I'm in a weird place with it. You've been king of the aggression with Bam. I have tried to point out kind of his responsibility as a hub and all of that. These last two games are the first two games where I've felt it. And I've talked about Bam needing a tell on whether he's going to face up and attack or face up and drive and attack in that kind of way. We've seen him mix it in during the regular season where it looks like he's going to the hub, but then he's just attacking. We haven't necessarily seen that mix. We've seen super aggressive at times, but we've seen the transition where it's clearly he's hunting for something, and for the crowd to see it and feel it says something. Now, for me, I think the error is just the mindset. Like, there was a couple plays that stood out to me. One, early in the game, I want to say Jaylen Brown was guarding him. Jimmy Butler had the ball on the wing. Jimmy had to point for Bam to go post up, and they threw it to him, and he scored, and then they didn't really explore getting back to that. And then there was a play, I want to say late in the game, where Bam had a chance to attack Grant Williams. It was in the second half. I don't know if it was late. And he kind of did, kind of didn't. Swung it to Oladipo, who really tried his best to drive. Mm-hmm. And you could see the Stark mindset. And that's where I don't know. I can't say I don't blame Bam, because it jumps off the page. You could see it. At the same time, I think I understand where his mindset is. And the focus for him has to understand the moment. Like, yes, you know the game. You know what Boston's doing defensively. You know your handoff's going to be a drop. The issue is your role isn't really there because they're in a drop and helping. So you're basically rolling into two guys.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like you're really popping. And if you are, you know, that's a shot they might live with or contest. So you have to know when to mix those attacks in and when to become a pressure point to make Boston think about what you're doing. And when you take the pressure off, you can see Boston's just comfortable. They don't have to show their hand, I would say. I guess more than comfortable. They don't have to show help. Because we've seen it when he has a post up against Derek White. I want to say the last game, here comes the help, here comes the strip, something like that. They're present of him. They don't want him to get going. But if you allow them to watch you, comes a different story. I thought the first half of that game between Miami and Boston was Miami trying their best. And, you know, you don't want to say the strategy was, hey, let's just rebound all our misses. But that
they
helped.
Crashed it.
They were crashing the glass. They were active. They were trying to get multiple efforts. You could see the shot quality felt a little different as far as the process went. The issue is, one, the more you watch this series, the more you know Miami has to take and make those shots against the drop. That's the key to this series for them offensively. They can't unlock anything else until they can beat that. And that's one of the tougher parts about the playoffs that gets lost sometimes. There's so many things we could talk about, but sometimes there's just that one thing you can't unlock or the one thing you can't stop that's just holding the rest of it back. You know, I mentioned for me personally, when we were in Memphis, it was just Chris Paul pick and roll in the fourth quarter. We can do all these other things, but if this hurts us in this two-minute stretch, we're cooked. Guarding the San Antonio Spurs. We can defend the first 15 seconds. What happens in the last 10 or 9? That's bad math. It's fine. Miami not being able to hit the pressure points to make Boston blink with that two big lineup is the one for me. Because if Al Horford can comfortably play in a drop and Robert Williams can comfortably roam and they can comfortably help, and you're not making them blink, you're not making them think, you're not making them come up to the level. Now that, you know, we talked about before the series, hey, what's the small lineup going to look like? Is the switching going to take Miami out of that? Boston hasn't even had to go to that. That's just like a plus. That's a bonus.
Yeah.
As opposed to that being the base, that's, hey, all right, we're just going to go ahead and try and cut your water off for a few minutes, see what we can get going. That's important. And That was the thing I felt in the first half. Miami was fighting. Miami was scrapping, but it never really felt like they shifted what Boston wanted to do defensively.
Mm-hmm.
We're still going to help off PJ. We're still going to mix in unders. We're still going to show help. We're still going to cut off the drive. And that's where Miami has to get to that blend of finding at least one thing. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. At least one thing that hurts them. I'll stop there before I start talking about Boston.
No, you're
sorry. I got going.
No, it's good stuff. Like on that front, against in the pick and roll in particular, that's what made Gabe Vincent's early stretch, his whole game, honestly. But that's what made the Gabe Vincent stretch in the first half so important. And in the third quarter, it was so important because Boston was in that drop and he was stepping into those pull-ups with confidence and knocking them down. And so one of the things Eric Spoelstra said after the game, as he looked at, I think the clip's out there now where he's like laughing once he actually looks at the box score and see what Miami shot from three. But he said like their shots were more in their wheelhouse in game one. Like he felt from a process standpoint, the spacing was better. The tempo was a little bit better. The shots they generated were fine, or at least they were better than they were in game four. And I felt that like getting the Duncan Robinson minutes out there was interesting. They needed him because Max Strus, once again, just hasn't been able to knock down shots. Kyle Lowry hasn't been able to knock down shots. And so against the drop, it hasn't just been static pick and roll that Boston's been able to sit at home against. Like they're going to their handoffs. They're going to some of their post splits. Like they had one from Max Strus that he just missed. Kyle Lowry cuts off the split. It was post up Jimmy Butler. Kyle Lowry splits. Max Strus pops above the break wide open off of coverage bus. He misses a shot. They go to this double stagger look with Duncan Robinson. It's defended well. Then it's a pitch. Duncan Robinson flips back the other way into a handoff. It's a wide open three with Al Horford in the drop. And he just missed. And so it was nice to see Miami like counter the drop with some more, I guess, exotic looks. They had a little bit more movement in there. They were able to get Boston's defense shifting around a little bit. But until the shots actually fall, and I hate to be this reductive, but until the shots actually fall, how much does good design matter now, especially in the postseason now? And so you design good things. The offense did look better, but it's still, they're still boxed in the half court. And if those shots don't fall, Boston continues to stay comfortable. They don't get a different look defensively. And Boston's just able to push off of their misses. And it just, more than anything, as the game was closer, the level of ease Boston had generating something good in the half court versus Miami, it just jumped off the page a lot.
Well, that's an interesting point because here's the thing. While Miami's searching for lineups and having to work hard to generate looks and get cracks in Boston's defense, Boston, while their process isn't always great, they have enough pressure points that they can hit to where even if it's a back and forth battle, we can swing with this. We can hit you with the shot making from Tatum and Brown. We can put pressure on you by having a man screen for Tatum that you don't want to switch on to him. We can poke those buttons. And the biggest thing that jumped off to me in that game was the dribble penetration that Boston got over and over and over again. And I thought that was the equalizer for Boston because I thought Miami did a good job guarding their sets. But, and I don't know if I want to say the tempo because sometimes it was sluggish, but when Boston got to swinging the ball and moving it, making quick decisions to drive, that made Miami a team that is usually very good at anticipating. And honestly, for a lot of the season, has dictated terms. They were reacting. And especially in that third quarter, we talk about the drives, free throws. You know, if Boston's able to keep you in the mud and then in the half court kind of live off free throws a little bit and transition stops, now that opens everything up for them. But for Boston to be able to drive and get free throws, drive and kick, driving kick for another kick and create shots that way outside of the set, that's huge for them to sustain offense in the half court. And then you look at the different ways, like the beauty of the playoffs for me, look at Derek White. One of your questions before this series on the preview with the great J.J. Redick was about Derek White, right? And this man stay on the floor. It's gone from that to he's getting screens set for him to matchup hunt.
Yeah.
And that's the fun of the playoffs. Every series is different. Every moment is different. Derek White, as a roller, has had an impact. This is someone you expected to have, you know, hey, we can help off him. No, he's in the action now. Think about it. I think Boston ran a play where he set a screen for Marcus Smart. And I was like, boy. Not necessarily because of the design, but if you think about it, as a defense, those are probably two of the guys that you're probably going to be okay with helping off of or feel comfortable with. They're in the action. So any sort of paint touch or kick is going to Tatum, Brown, or Al Horford. And poof, there you go. So it's those little things that Boston's done for me. I thought Miami, the tough part of Miami is they went small, Boston was able to kind of switch. They had more of a mindset to drive, but Boston also had more of a mindset to drive. So it kind of evened it out for me.
Like the Heat just didn't have, they just didn't have the bodies to deal with what Boston was trying to do. And the whole thing with going small, you want a little bit more ground coverage defensively. Offensively, you want to open up more space for your drivers. You want to have more shooting on the floor. If those shots aren't falling, and like you said, Boston also has the mindset to get downhill, and they're doing so with their double big lineup, they're just winning the paint points at that point. Like, you're missing shots, they're grabbing the defensive rebounds. You're not getting the offensive rebounds you were getting in the first half with your small unit against their big unit. And then on the other end, like, the rim protection is PJ Tucker. And if he's involved in the action, and as we've seen all series long, PJ's had the Jason Tatum matchup, but it's, hey, Derek White, come set a screen for me. Whoever Max Strus is defending, or whoever Gabe Vincent is defending, or whoever Kyle Lowry is defending, hey, come set a screen. And what I liked from Boston was, let me get a screen from Marcus Smart first. I'm going to pitch it to him. He's going to pitch it back to me. Now let me call Duncan Robinson to the action, since he's on Al Horford right now. Get a switch, and now what do you do? Is Horford slipping against smaller guys and an even smaller back line? Or it's Tatum getting the matchup and he has a weak defender on him. You have to show help. That's just opening up more cracks. So to your point.
No, nah, give Ime his credit, man. Because he did that in the first half too with Derek White.
Get it.
Add Horford screen for Tatum. Hey, man. Jimmy and Bam, you guys switch. Hey, Derek White, come set a screen. Oh, wait. Where's Bam? He's spaced. Oh, wait. Give Ime Udoka his, hey, man. Y'all got some apologizing to do. I'm sorry.
Ime's done the thing. Ime's done the thing. He just
I'll continue. I'm sorry.
No, I appreciate that. But no, like, much like I can applaud some of the counters Miami threw against the drop for Boston, they just didn't make down the shots. They just didn't knock down the shots. Boston had some half-court funk, too. And they were able to not just high pick and roll, static, force a matchup, 7 on the clock, now we have to attack. That was some of the complaints that I had for Boston earlier in the series. Now it's, we just want to find a matchup. Not only do we want to find a matchup, we are going to, again, we're going to move Bam out the way first. We're going to get Jimmy matched up on Al Horford first, and then it's called for the screen. And so now Jimmy, who is an all-world help defender, he has to think a little bit because Al Horford has been shooting well all piece postseason long. And that's kind of where that equity from early in the rounds kind of stack up for you. Where heading into the postseason, it's okay. We know Al can shoot, but he's going to be a comfortable help point until he proves it. It was the same thing with Grant Williams. You get 2 rounds of Al Horford shooting 40%+ from three. It's like, okay, well, we can't really do this. And then you have Al Horford mixing in some of the pump and drives and also just some of the random cuts. You can't really afford to just help off cleanly anyway. And so there's just been enough in Boston's half court process that I've liked. And it just feels even more backbreaking for Miami because they're having to work so much harder on the other end of the floor to generate good looks.
Yeah. I mean, if you think about even just that first half, the Boston wasn't shooting the ball great. 4-for-16 from 3, 13-for-34 from the field, 10 turnovers. Tatum Brown had 3 made field goals, but they had 13 made field goals, 11 assists. So all they had to do was survive. The problem for Miami is while they were kind of surviving some of the challenges that Boston had shown, they didn't really thrive in one area that they needed to really put that pressure on. So it's got to be a blend for Miami offensively because they have the defense. And even with the breakdowns off the bounce, some of the matchup issues, they can get Boston in the mud. The problem is it doesn't have an impact if you are also stuck in the half court. And now Boston can survive on transition opportunities. And, you know, I don't know how you get Jimmy right. I don't know what, you know, if Boston's literally saying, hey, we treated him like a big. Interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, that was a loud statement that was made right there. That's the thing. Here's the thing about this playoff run. There's only one period in time that Al Horford felt like a little bit of a pressure point for Boston. And that was a few stretches against Giannis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, no one's been able to really get him off the floor or make him someone that they have to help against. And so how you unlock Jimmy's gonna be interesting because they took Peyton Pritchard out of the rotation, low-key.
Yep.
So they're putting lineups out there where they're like, hey, there's not a soul out here that we don't think can't guard you in any of the areas that you like to operate. And so we're going to put a big on you if you want to drive, we'll contest. Put small on you, just be active and go under and take away your rhythm shots. And so it's going to be on them to kind of find the cracks, kind of find the creases. Bam has to be aggressive. It's got to be a blend. Here comes Jimmy. Kyle Lowry pull up. Now we got some action drawing. You got to kind of get something to where it's like you're a moving target again, which they're trying, but nothing's really landed. But all that doesn't matter. If they can't keep the ball in front defensively, it's going to be tough.
It'd be tough indeed. And just on the Boston front, because you mentioned them, what a performance from Derek White. This is what a run for Derek White. Last few games, like obviously missed the game with the birth of his child, but since he's been back, the drives have been different. You talked a little bit earlier about his usage as a screener and being able to get provide value that way. Defensively, I am so impressed with the screen navigation from him. He has made life incredibly difficult. Like Max Strus has missed some open shots, but he can't get open. It's taking two or three flips and handoffs just to get him a shot sometimes. Because Derek White in these rear view contests, like he's already gotten a couple blocks like that in the series where he's like, oh, you think you have a pull up three, you just don't. I've been wildly impressed with what he's been able to do. And that's an apt point that you made. Like Peyton Pritchard didn't play much, if at all, in game five. And so if the worst defender on the floor, not even the worst defender, if the size mismatch that you want to hunt now goes from Peyton Pritchard to Derek White, that's an uphill battle. And we've seen throughout the course of this series, in particular in game five, like we've seen stretches where Al Horford's on Jimmy Butler. Like if Bam's the screener and Rob Williams defended him, Al Horford's on Jimmy Butler. That's a help point for him. And if you flip that, if Al Horford's directly involved as the pick and roll screener, Rob Williams has PJ Tucker or Jimmy Butler, and he's able to roam off. And I guess I'm just waiting, if we're talking about counters on that front, like I'm waiting on some more of the I'm waiting on some off-ball screens from PJ or Jimmy in that regard.
PJ did one, I want to say, in the first half. I thought Miami was going to bookmark that. He was spacing the corner. I forget who was in the action. Sorry, Dunkers. But pick and roll happened. He was in the corner. He sets a flare for Strus because Robert Williams is watching. So how much of that can they get to? And again, like you don't have to land it every time. It just has to be a thought. You got to plant something along with shot making, obviously, but you got to plant something in Boston's head to get them out of being so convicted in their defense, which has been really good, really swarming, mixing in coverages, unders, switches, help defense, locked in. Because we could talk about all the things you're searching for, X's and O's. It comes down to shooting, but also once a team kind of gets that mindset where, hey, we're just not going to guard 2.5 of these guys out here. As much as you battle and fight, eventually you still have to deal with that portion of it. And to me, that was what this game was. Like, hey, good first half. We're still here.
But again, there's only so much you could do on that front. And yeah, like I'm just waiting on more of the screens because like the common thing has just been PJ spacing and then cutting in for offensive rebounds or Jimmy Butler's off the ball. It's a lot of cuts. And like a small thing, and like shout out Siobhan Beslow at Miami Heat Beat. This is something that she's pointed out quite a bit during the regular season. It's a lot of Bam being involved in the action with someone and then Jimmy Butler cutting while he's trying to roll. Like there's been a little bit of those kind of things. And you can't really have that against this Boston team that already wants to shrink the floor against you. And they're already helping off of other guys. Like it's, and I think you made this point, like you can't afford to have mishaps against Boston in the half court. You just can't. Like their defense is good enough. You can't also help them with poor spacing, ill-timed cuts, turnovers that let them get out and run. Like you just can't have that. And so credit to Boston for making life incredibly tough for Miami. And Miami has to do a little soul searching. They got to make some shots. They got to get healthy.
Yeah, they do. They still got a shot, but they got a lot of boxes they got to check off. Back to your point as far as counters go, What was interesting to me is Miami was like, hey, let's go back to empty corner. That worked for us. And Al Horford was like, I'm in a drop still. And you know what? It's even better. I'm just going to, my drop's going to be with Bam's role. So enjoy that.
And also, here's Robert Williams roaming over from the weak side behind that. So if you you want to make that pass, you got that. Good luck trying to make that skip pass with Robert Williams or Al Horford on the way. And hey, Jason Tatum's a really good off-ball defender. So yeah, good luck with that. Woo! This Boston defense, man. This Boston defense. Very impressive stuff. Let's get into, we did ask the dunkers to send in some questions. Thank you for those who did so. If you have questions for us moving forward, again, drop them in the email. It is dunkerspot@yahoo.com. Shoot them in. Let's dig into some of these to kind of close out the Heat Celtics segment. This one comes from Anthony. He says, for Steve, what wrestlers would you compare Heat Celtics to? Let me just stop there. That's a tremendous question. This is right in your wheelhouse. What match does this remind you of?
I'm going to compare this series to the Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, Iron Man match at WrestleMania. I'm just going to leave it at that.
There we go. Get your Peacock subscription. Go to YouTube. Check out that match if you haven't already. Oh, man. Good stuff. All right. Let's go to Dylan, since this has kind of been a national talking point very quietly. We can just kind of mix the Dylan and Dan questions. Dylan says, if you're Eric Spoelstra, what are you changing to try to give this Heat team a chance to win two in a row against the Celtics? And Dan asks, do you think the Heat should bench Kyle Lowry and give Gabe Vincent the start instead? Steve, what would you do with the point guard room in Miami?
Is this a thing? Maybe I've been enjoying like the actual basketball content a little too much. Is this a thing? Kyle Lowry didn't have to come back.
I mean, that's true.
He's out here trying to fight. It happens. Is he playing well? No, he's not. He'll be the first person to tell you that. Does he need to pull up, mix in some of those pull-ups? Absolutely. He's got to be a part of that as well. Like, as far as that was the guy I had as the X factor, because, hey, he can switch on a lot of different guys. And, hey, he can make those pull-ups. He has to do that. He has not done that. I don't know that you give Gabe Vincent the start, because then what are you going to do, just bring Lowry off the bench? So, older player with hamstring issue, warms up, sits down, then comes in the game. If you want to shorten the leash, hey, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But you need Lowry to have that mindset. And I think we saw, he came back in game three, right?
Yes.
At least for me, I saw the potential of, oh, that's what it means. Because, wow, Miami now has a lineup where they feel like comfortable switching everyone. Now, Boston quickly said, all right, Max Strus, you come here. And now, you know, Kyle Lowry has been in show and recover as well. So, I mean, I think with putting Gabe Vincent out there, you're giving Boston basically a bullseye right from the jump, which I don't know if you want to do in an elimination game. So, you know, I understand the idea of, hey, Gabe's going to be aggressive. Gabe's going to get the pull up, but you need to find something with your first unit. Now Gabe comes in, gives you a burst with that second unit off the dribble. He's aggressive. Now you kind of have that wave a little bit. So I don't think that. But we could just talk about the Bahamas and all sorts of nonsense if you want to.
The hashtag is a bit confused.
Dylan. Dylan, I didn't mean to disrespect you. What are you trying, changing? I think we'll see more zone earlier. I think we'll just see more of a mindset to just let it fly. And Miami, for all the warts they've shown, I don't think they're going to go away easily. I may not make any of those shots, but it's going to be a tough out. Go ahead, Nikash.
Okay, I would say on the actual adjustment front, just kind of echo something I said earlier. Like, I'm just waiting to see more off-ball screening to kind of counter Al Horford or Robert Williams helping off from the weak side as much as they are. And one of the videos that you pointed out in your thread, there was a high pick and roll. What I think I want to say it was Lowry and Bam, and PJ was in a strong side corner, and that's just easy help. Or I think that was Jaylen Brown that was able to do that. I don't think you can have PJ Tucker in the strong side. Like, that's making it a little bit too easy, because now you're at that point, you're cutting off the pull up and the roll at the same time. Like, you're already fighting to open up a pocket there. Keep PJ on the weak side of your action if you can help it. Roll towards the side with shooters. And then again, get something going where you have PJ screening so you can at least make Boston's defense think a little bit. That's probably the primary one. Again, from a process standpoint, offensively overall, like I was fine with Miami did. They just missed a lot of shots. And I don't know. Like, there's only so much I can say about that. Like, you either make the shots or you don't. Like, that would be a nice – that's not an adjustment. That's just playing better.
Ah, the good old make or miss league. I love it.
We are here. As far as starting Vincent over Kyle Lowry, I think I'm a little bit more open to it than you are, though you make a very valid point about like just the general rhythm of him coming off the bench now, trying to keep the hamstring warm and stuff. So I think after hearing that, like, I think I'm more inclined with shorten the leash, because I think it was apparent early on. Well, not even early on. Like, I think once you got later into the first, because there were some strong drives from Kyle Lowry against the drop, and it turned into a peel switch and he was able to kind of create from there. And so like the juice was there early. But as the game went on, it's like, okay, he really can't move the way you need him to. And now he's just not shooting as much. Now the drives aren't hitting the same, and now Miami's deeper into the clock, and you're just not getting the same effect. And defensively, as much as he fights, as smart as he is, he's still 6 foot at the end of the day. Like, he's stronger, but at least Gabe Vincent does give you a little bit more size in that regard. And so, like, I probably lean towards you still start Kyle if he's good enough to play, but I wouldn't be upset if the minutes are like even or Gabe Vincent plays a little bit more if Kyle doesn't have it going early. So that would probably be my shift on that front. This one comes from, well, these couple come from Josh on the Celtics front. He says, if you were the Celtics front office, you 100% spend the money to keep Al Horford on the roster next year, correct?
Yes. Demon time is going to equal the, truck backing up with green in it.
Bring the Brinks. Yeah, you bring Al Horford back. Like, he's, what a season he's had. And we've talked about this throughout the year, like, just kind of waiting on, all right, he's been really good, but he's had a lot of on his plate. Like, I wonder when it's going to start to hit. It just hasn't.
It never did. It never did. We should have known when he had that week where he guarded everyone known to man. What was it? Trae Young, Kyrie, Ja. I'm not looking it up right now. But he guarded everyone in like a 4-game stretch. And I was like, wow, Al's still here. And then he just did it in the playoffs.
Yeah, like if he still got that, then you can maybe lower his minutes a little bit next season just to keep him fresh for the playoffs. But yeah, you absolutely bring him back. Don't try to get funky with the contract and stuff. Bring him back. He's earned it. He is a locker room leader that multiple players have raved about throughout this season. Yes, absolutely. Shout out Al Horford in the year that he's had, the stretch that he's had. Al Horford's really good. The second one, and one more follow-up question, if you'll bear with me. As good as Al has been and as careful as he is about taking care of his body, Father Time is undefeated. Who do you think they can bring in to in subsequent free agent years to try and help fill his role? Almost had a KG moment there. All right. Robert Williams is incredible. We're going to need to keep as much wear and tear off him as possible, given the injury history. On that front, like, I'm not 100% sure where to go with that. Because Boston has tried to cycle in a bunch of like third and fourth bigs. We're not going to talk about one of them. But they've tried to cycle in some bigs just to kind of keep that regular season rotation intact. I guess, actually, let me flip this to you. Just in terms of prototype, like, what type of big would you like for them to have?
I don't think it's a big. I think it's someone who can guard multiple positions. Okay. I think it's a wing-ish player. You're not going to find a big that's like Al Horford. That's no disrespect to bigs, but he just has a really unique skill set and ability to defend a whole lot of people in a smart way. That doesn't necessarily grow on trees. Not that you can't develop it, but I think you just go with more of a wing-ish player. Someone who can play the four, maybe guard 1 through 4. Because you probably could feel comfortable with Jaylen Brown guarding certain people that are tall. So I think you just add to your wing room to add to the depth to the lineup versatility that you have. Now you can cycle different looks in, you know, and kind of protect it that way.
Okay.
And maybe... that'll slide out to more 5 minutes or something like that, you know, in theory.
I know. I like that. So you're basically looking for another, like, Grant Williams-ish type player.
Williams-White adjacent, I guess. Someone who can do that, doesn't need a lot, big space the floor. Like,
are you saying Boston should
Robert Covington?
Would have been fun. Are you suggesting that the Celtics should try to trade for Kenrich Williams this offseason and get him into rotation?
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Dunker Spot. We are brought to you. We're not brought to you by anybody. We're on all major platforms. You can find us on Apple, Spotify, Google.
This is amazing.
Eat some beans. I don't know. What else
you eat some beans. Not in the movie theater, though. That's not safe. Oh, man. But no, I feel you on that front. Like, I was trying to think, like, I don't think. Honestly, Boston would probably feel comfortable rolling with Daniel Tice like a third big for the regular season. Because I think he is fine in your big man rotation during the regular season, the way that they work him in.
I think he's fine in the playoffs with the right matchup. Mm-hmm. But he definitely has liability adjacent qualities come playoff time. Unless you're just consumed with the drop. Which is funny. He probably could have played in this series the way they're weak side defense is, but
yeah,
I get it.
Yeah, definitely. I guess last thing here, now I'm just thinking about the big man room. Like, if they don't keep Tice or whatever the case may be on that front, I think with what they've gotten from Robert Williams when they're healthy, my guess, if Boston wants to add like a third bit to help save some wear and tear, like, one, I'm with you, they probably look for more of a forward just so they'll have another guy, but also I think they would want another like violent rim roller, rim protector, like in the Robert Williams mold, just so they can keep some semblance of that in the case that Williams gets hurt again. Because the dynamic with him and Al Horford is tremendous. And so if you can replicate that with someone on your second unit, then I think that's probably a way to go. And like, it's, I don't want to be disrespectful and say it's easy to find those guys, but like, there are a lot of bigs within that prototype that they can kind of try out and see if they can give you a solid 12, 15 minutes during the regular season.
So we spent 10 minutes on this question for you to want the Celtics to sign Mason Plumlee.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunkers. All right, let's get into the game that just ended. The Warriors were able to knock off the Dallas Mavericks 120-110. They win the series 4-1. I was very much wrong about the series. I had the Mavs pushing it to 7. Just before even digging into what happened in game 5, just props to Golden State for this run. I didn't see it coming this year. Like, I thought they'd be good. I didn't see this. And for them to get the year they had from Steph on both ends of the floor, even with the shooting kind of slumping to his from his regular levels, for him to have the impact that he had for Draymond when he was on the court to be a defensive player of the year level talent, and he showcased that throughout this entire postseason run to this point. The growth from Jordan Poole, Klay Thompson bouncing back from injury after injury after injury, and to cap it off with a 32-point game, 8 made threes. He made some absolute kill shots in this game 5. I just find myself impressed with what Golden State has been able to do. And here they are, 4 wins away from a championship.
No, I mean, I think from the start, we saw the template, what they could do on both ends of the floor, and it's come together through ups and downs, highs and lows. And this is kind of what you want to see as you build a team, as you navigate through a season. What do we do well? What do we struggle with? Can we evolve? Can we grow? Can we take the lumps? Can we handle the adversity? Can we come together when it matters the most? And that's what they've done on this run. And the play of Wiggins during the regular season paying off, the play of Poole in the regular season paying off, continuing to work with Looney paying off in this series, allowing him to do different things, mm-hmm. paying off now. The bench being able to plug and play different guys. You know, you have an elimination game where Nemanja is having an impact. That's big. You have the development to where Kuminga and Moses Moody can have opportunities to grow and contribute to winning basketball, play their role while still being asked, you know, to grow as players, not just be X, Y, and Z. Yeah, we need you to bring that every night, but you can also show some other things, have some freedom. You see them have impact on this run. So it's been an impressive and fun thing to see it all kind of come together at the right time. And now they're back in the finals. That's a special moment for a team that it looked like their run was done. Mm-hmm. And for them to put the work in to get back to this level, you know, for Klay Thompson to go through that level of adversity and then have that kind of game to get back to the finals, it's insane. So, I mean, you gotta give a salute to the Warriors. They put the work in.
That they did six finals in eight seasons when you zoom out and look at this thing. And the core has remained consistent. Steph Curry, Klay Thompson back in the fold, Draymond Green. The pieces around them have switched around. It was just those three. You get the Kevin Durant run. You now have Andrew Wiggins plugging in and being impactful on both ends of the floor for you. The work that he did on Luka Doncic throughout this series was impressive. Bleeding the clock with full court pressure, staying attached to his hip, was never really in foul trouble throughout this series. And with the level of craft that Luka has once he gets inside the arc, to be able to stay disciplined, stay with him, deal with those body bumps, deal with all the fakes, and just make life incredibly tough for him. You may see 40 in the box score for Luka, but none of it came easy, really. And so I'm just really impressed with what he was able to do. This was, in the case of Andrew Wiggins, this is someone I looked at when he got the All-Star berth, like, wait, what are we doing here? He's been good. He hasn't been this. He's given them All-Star level impact throughout this postseason run. Not just what he's doing defensively, not just the shot making and the drives. The commitment to the glass on both ends for Andrew Wiggins. This hasn't been something that he's done consistently in his entire career. And so for him to be one of the NBA leaders in offensive rebounds in this postseason run, it's incredible to see that switch flip and to see him contribute to winning basketball in that way. It's been fun to watch.
No, they hit all the right notes on both ends. I do also want to salute Dallas for the year and the run that they had. I don't think anyone saw this coming or had them here mm-hmm. in the conference finals. And it was a valiant effort. Obviously, I'm sure we'll talk about what they do next, but to get back to the conference finals for the first time in, what, 10-ish years, right?
A long time, yeah.
10-plus years. It takes guts to fight through what they looked like at the beginning. Mm-hmm. And we both had our questions about what they looked like at the beginning. Offensively, didn't look great. Defensively, didn't look great. But to kind of just work through it, find a way to kind of have the guts to make that trade.
Yeah.
Where you get Porzingis out of there because you found something that fits Luka and you added to what you're trying to build. And then they found it and they believed in each other, you know? They had the kind of bigs that would help Luka, and they found Luka just being a pressure point and developing in such a high fashion to where it doesn't matter what pick and roll coverage you want to throw at me. You want to play drop? That's cool. I'll just lead the dance and navigate. You want to put two on the ball? Please do. I'm taking two dribbles and I'm going to find whatever pass is open. And that pressure plus Luka's post-ups plus the emergence of Jalen Brunson, getting consistent minutes, growing, scoring, getting post-ups, Dinwiddie coming in off the bench and adding that value to their guard lineup, and then the playoff run. I mean, buying in defensively and taking things off the table for two really good teams.
Yeah, not just two really good. I mean, obviously two really good teams, but these were two of the four best offenses in basketball.
Yeah. And they made them look completely different than they had played all season. That's a huge accomplishment. And then offensively, to have just the mindset and understanding of and belief, you know, we joked about they're not really running any plays, but that's tough to just come down and be like, I'm going to beat you off the dribble and we're just going to play out of it and it work. Mm-hmm. So it's salute to Dallas. What they do next is going to be interesting because this is one of, if I believe, one of the tougher spots to manage in the league. Overachieving. I don't mean that in a bad way. But when success comes a little faster than you may have expected, you got some decisions to make. Mm-hmm. Is this the core? Did we find something? What do we need to add to it? It's similar to me, and I hate to do it because of the trade Luka thing, but to the Hawks run. Where, yeah, you found something in a run. There's no guarantee that run can happen again because that West is tough. So I'm interested to see what Dallas does going forward. But they fought their tails off. They fought their tails off. Golden State just really wouldn't cooperate at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. I thought they found something in game four as far as, hey, we're just going to poke a little bit of holes in what you got. And unfortunately, they needed Golden State to play down a level offensively to keep it in the mud, and they just couldn't get there consistently, but they put the effort in.
Yeah, that they did. And like we talked about this a little bit earlier in the series, just the shift from what Dallas had seen in the first two rounds to what they were getting in Golden State. And now that's going to be a big, that's also going to be a key factor with whoever comes out of these, whether Boston ends it on Friday, they end it on Sunday, or if the Heat are able to pull it off. Both of those teams are going to be coming from, you know, there's movement in their offenses, but it's not Golden State. It's not Stephen Curry. Just in terms of the initial action is going to be different. And then you get into what Golden State is able to do beyond that initial action with the random cuts, the random relocations. It's going to be a whole ordeal there.
It's going to be a culture shock. I mean, even let's use Boston as an example. You play Milwaukee, not seasoned. Play Miami that has movement, not to the same level, but the same type of shooters and the same type of threats in pick and roll. So it's a different beast. And again, you have to hope that Golden State helps you out with some turnovers, or they fall into, we're going to just do this for a little bit, some stretches where they just kind of lose focus. Mm-hmm. Gets a little dribble happy, ball movement's not there, player movement's not there, but there's some pressure points out there. As far as Steph Curry, we're going to do two on the ball, or you're going to switch. Robert Williams is going to have a little bit different role if Boston advances. Sure, you can help, but you got to come back up to the level. We've seen that in both these series where let's help all the way off Draymond. Oh, wait, who's coming off?
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be that kind of blend. Now, the interesting part with either of these teams, Boston or Miami, there is an activity and a physicality and a switchability with all of those teams. And that could bring Golden State into the mud a little bit with the denials, with the ball pressure. Maybe drag them deeper in the clock, make them maybe force them into something different. So lineups are going to be so important. I'm sure we'll dive into it as we go forward, but They both have small-ish or small adjacent lineups that can do a lot of switching against what Golden State likes to do.
Mm-hmm.
And now how does Golden State react to that aspect of it? Because Dallas was active, but maybe couldn't keep the ball in front as much as they wanted to. We've seen Golden State have a lot of success in the paint, and we've seen both of these teams have success cutting things off in the paint. And that's kind of a key piece for Golden State. So it's not just the threes. It's the fact that we have all this that we're throwing at you. We have this blend. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if a team like Boston or Miami can get into them, keep the ball in front, it may be interesting. So I think it'll be fun. But, yeah, it's going to be a whole different world if Golden State continues on the path of what they're supposed to do offensively. And with each series, I feel like they've gotten better. But there's always those stretches where they just kind of forget what they're doing, or I don't want to say forget, that's strong, but they just kind of start hooping a little bit. And now it's an 8-0 run.
I am with you on that. And I think this, just the nerd in me or whatever, I'm glad that this is the Eastern Conference Finals we have. Because again, Dallas is a switchy unit. They were locked in for most of the year defensively. Got off to a rough start, and Jason Kidd called it out early. And from then on, they were a top seven, top eight defense. And so, like, there's a level of discipline and switchability there. But as you hit on, Boston switched more than any team in the NBA, or switched at a higher rate than any team in the NBA. Miami was second. And just that level of connectedness that both of those teams have on the defensive end is going to be a little bit different than what you saw from Boston. I mean, from Dallas. That'll be a little bit different from what you saw from Memphis, who has the athleticism. They had like an athletic front court and things that could take some stuff away. But as we talked about a little bit early on in that second round series, they would defend the initial action fine. And then it's, wait, where's Ja? Wait, where's Jaren? Wait, where's Brandon Clark going? Wait, you're not staying attached to these shooters after the play. Miami and Boston, they key in a little bit more. Like, there's a little bit more experience there. Just the personnel is just better. And so I am excited with whoever comes out of the East. Like, that is going to be a battle in the half court.
I think it's going to be a fun finals. Either way, I think it's going to be a fun finals. You wonder how much, because even on the other side of the coin, if you look at Boston and the run they've had, Brooklyn, let's find the mismatches and attack those. Milwaukee, they had to work against drop and switches and evolve through that. Golden State kind of has a unique blend, but they're going to put Steph Curry in action if it's Boston. Mm-hmm. That's for sure. That's been proven. They're going to put Jordan Poole in action. There's going to be pieces of what Dallas did that's going to show back up, and Boston's been doing that the whole time. The question again for me, if it's Boston, is can Kevon Looney hold up? He answered that very well in the Dallas series.
Boy, did he. Shout out Kevon Looney, man.
Yeah. His defense, as far as switching, staying in front, doing his job, it was impressive the entire series. And I had big questions about him coming into it. So I focused a lot of attention on the small lineup. They didn't have to lean on it that much. But hey, can that small lineup be a threat against Boston's lineups? You know, whether it's Horford at the five. Now you got Smart, White, Tatum, Brown. Let's just throw for example. What's that look like? Can you generate the same quality look? So Miami on the other end, be interesting to see what kind of looks they get if they were advanced. What kind of pressure is put on them on that end? Because I think Golden State may be able to lock in a little bit more on Boston just because of the way the offense is maybe run.
Yeah.
Miami, if they advance, may find freedom, may feel like a little too strong because Golden State's very good defensively. Mm-hmm. But there may be more opportunity for them to get closer to what they do than in this Boston series.
Yeah, I think there's just a size difference.
Yeah. Not the same size, not the same length. So it'd be interesting to see if they were to advance, if they have that kind of right of jail feel to them.
Mm-hmm.
Fun stuff.
Fun stuff indeed. Before we get into the mailbag questions, just on the what does Dallas do from here portion of it, do I think this is the core? I'm not 100% sure. Like, I do think they need to bring Jalen Brunson back. Like, just that, the drives, the pull-ups, the post-ups, you hit on it already. I'm not going to rehash all of that. But, like, he seems like a really good complement to what Luka does. And he's shown that he can carry the offense in spurts with Luka off the bench. And you have Dinwiddie there as well. Like, I think that's, with as special as Luka is offensively, I think Brunson and Dinwiddie is enough to complement what he does. It's like a driver. I don't think they need like a pure star number two for that, Matt, for that. I think the improvements are going to come, one, with shooting, which, depending on if they keep him, Tim Hardaway Jr. will help with quite a bit when he's healthy. But then there's an upgrade to be made in the front court. And I think that's where I go if we're looking what's the big swing Dallas could make this offseason. We're talking about this a little bit in the watch party. See what the price is for Rudy Gobert. See what the price is for a Clint Capella. Like, those two names in particular, I would just kick the tires on. Like, Hardaway Jr., another piece of pick. What does that get me in the room for? Because I think if you have a better version of Dwight Powell at the five on both ends of the floor, like, you can generate more, you can generate looks a little bit easier in pick and roll if Rudy Gobert is rolling or if Clint Capella is rolling versus a Dwight Powell. And I think with as much as they switched, they did also drop two. I think it's just a different look for opposing offenses if it's Clint or if it's Rudy Gobert versus a Dwight Powell. Not to say he's bad at either of those roles, but like there's just another tier they can get to that I think they can kind of unlock them on both ends. So I think that's kind of the big thing, like just improve the big man room. And if you can add some shooting on the margin, see what kind of growth you're going to get from a Josh Green. Like, I talked about what the minutes looked like with him. Like, teams did say, hey, we're just not going to guard this dude. But I think the defensive reps that he got throughout the postseason are important. And I think what he saw offensively, it wasn't great. And I'm sure the plus minus would show that as well. But like, that experience is helpful. I think that's a key for him. Like, okay, I need to really develop this corner shot. I allow Dorian Finney-Smith. And you saw the growth that he's made throughout his career in Dallas. I need to develop a corner shot. Or I need to figure out something with the ball in my hands. Do I need to become a better screener? Do I need to be more comfortable getting into floater range and short rolling? If teams are going to, if they're going to involve me as a screener, if they're going to help off like this, can I get better in those areas, in those micro skills, so I'll have more of a role next year? But I think Dallas is in a good spot. Like, Luka has proven he's a top 6, top 7 player at worst already. That gives you a floor if he's healthy. You have drivers. You have shooters. You've shown you have some versatility, what you want to do, in terms of lines you want to get to. You can add another piece. You can upgrade what you have. But, like, the foundation is strong. But to your point, the West is getting stronger. And so that's why I think it's imperative. They're going to make a move, I think, improve the front court. Start there. Build out from there.
Well, for me, if you're going to improve the front court, you just got to make sure you get a big that works with Luka.
Mm-hmm.
Because say what you want about Powell, Maxey, and Dave Burt. They all have skill sets that kind of work with what Luka likes to do and being able to build around that offense. And, you know, you don't, while you are going to spam pick and roll, you don't necessarily have to in a certain sense. You know, if you're going to go get Clint Capella or someone like that, that's going to be his usage. So does that shift how you're doing things? I think trying to, I mean, Tim Hardaway Jr. comes back. What does that look like? Does that help your lineup versatility in a way that makes everything shift? I mean, the issue is you kind of have all these guys making them around the same salary wise.
Mm-hmm.
And so are you going to get a leap? Who's going to make another leap for you? Or are you banking on continuity to carry you to a certain extent? You know, I think lineup versatility would be the key for me. Being able to maybe just have more options to throw out there, feel comfortable with smaller lineups or giving different looks in that way, add to the, I guess, the wing room potentially.
Mm-hmm.
DFS took a step. Reggie Bullock is Reggie Bullock, but then who's next? You know, so can anyone take a leap there? And then make sure you have the right kind of pieces. You know, if you need a roller, you need a spacer, you need someone who can kind of do both for your big. So if you can get someone better, that's fine, but it's got to be built around what Luka is looking to accomplish. That part is clear.
Sure. Sounds like a plan. Let's get into a couple of mailbag questions before we officially put a bow on this series. This from our guy, Stefan Noh, who says he has a couple for us. Steve had mentioned before that Ryan Anderson destroyed Memphis when they were trying to show on pick and rolls back around 2014-15. What did Anderson do to crush it? Was it slip, flipping the angle, something else? Can you lend some insight into what Ryan Anderson did against Memphis?
Why y'all trying to do this to me, man? Why y'all trying to traumatize me? He tortured us with like a combination of all of that. Like, he was so good at slipping the screen. Like, the coverage against shooting bigs was, we're going to show and recover. It's what you see from guards now. That was our coverage with bigs. That was how we played shooting bigs. And he would just do such a good job of coming, and his footwork was great. So it's 2 feet, and I'm out. And the spacing was always that he was popping into, like, a wide open side. Or there's a shooter in the corner. So it was a stunt, but this man was open. Or he'd flip the angle of his screen real quick. So you're about to show, he flips it, now he's popping. It's like, what on earth? And it's like, all right, maybe we shouldn't do that. Let's just go to the level. Pop. Okay, let's not do that. It's just, it was annoying. And then he'll catch it, get a hand off, now quick flip into a screen. Now you're trying to show, just torture. And it's, show and recover is different with bigs than it is with guards. Like, that takes a lot for them to get up to the level and show out and then recover to the pop, which is why that coverage kind of just went bye-bye for a while. And, I mean, you have to do it with guards of a certain size or else what are you doing? But, yeah, that's what he did. Thanks.
Well, sorry to put you back through
that. That's fine. Give me the follow-up. It's fine.
Okay, the follow-up. While we're talking about showing and recovering, is why have the Warriors been able to show with Curry so much and avoid getting crushed in that same manner?
A lot of it has to do with what the screener can do and how much can you live with it from them. So while Reggie Bullock is a shooter, if he's shooting the ball X amount of times, you can probably live with that to a certain degree. And mainly the success that Golden State had with that coverage, Steph was on it.
Mm-hmm.
He was engaged. And so the conviction they had with that really played a key part because they put him in a lot of action over this course of the series. And every time he was there, level, show, do my job, I get back. And having that kind of repetition, having that kind of mindset kind of takes a little bit of the table off. Because when we talk about defense and defensive coverages, yeah, sometimes the scheme has exploits, but also what the offense does can have an impact. You know, do I trust that I can hold for this long? You know, for a show and recover, whoever's guarding the ball has to trust that that show is going to come so they can duck under. And whoever's showing has the trust that they can give back out to theirs. And if anything kind of fades a little bit, now you have maybe a show that's flat, or maybe, you know, someone trying to fight over a screen. Now you got two on the ball for a brief second. And so that can throw it out of whack. But when you're nailing it time and time and time again, it either takes it off the table or you just live with the result. And I felt like Golden State was very firmly in this series. We're going to live with the result. No matter, even if you ding us. You know, you might turn the corner one time, you might reject, you might hit a three, but we're still going to do the same thing. And that's so important come playoff time, because mentally, all you're trying to do is get the other team to play differently. Take your strengths off the table, make you think about what you're supposed to be doing, maybe make you stop doing something you do very well. Like, we don't even talk about that enough. Sometimes the adjustment is a bluff. We're hoping if we do this well enough, you just stop doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you fall for the bait and it's like, oh, we got a whole new series now.
You got to worry about this anymore.
you forgot. Like, it's, you forgot that this was the matchup, huh? You forgot that this post-up was really working. Okay, sweet. Now we live. That's a topic for a different pod.
All right. We will circle back to that one then. One last question. We already touched on a little bit, so we can get more into the second portion of it. But anyway, the whole question is from Anthony. Says, as far as Dallas is concerned, considering how they've looked in the series, or how they looked in the series at this point, what type of player is the perfect second fiddle to Luka? And depending on who that is, does the heliocentric style of play need some tweaking moving forward for Dallas?
Perfect second fiddle, someone who can create, but is okay with playing off the ball.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's a guard or a wing, but I think it's that. Someone who is a pressure point as well, but doesn't need 20 shots to be a pressure point, where now you have to kind of force feed it in a sense. Now, for me, I go back to Porzingis. In theory, he had a lot of the skill set that should have matched with Luka. The issue was you had to do certain things. You know, we got to get it to him in the post to keep him engaged. Pick and roll is now a switch that the defense feels they can live with.
That's the big one.
So that to me is you kind of got to find the balance. So does it need a heliocentric means one person, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's late. Forgive me. I ask this question every time someone says it. I'm sorry. It's tweaking. I don't know. Only because he continues to develop in the ways that he can hurt you. Like, we talked about how much he can hurt all your coverages and pick and roll and what that can open up for Dallas. But don't forget, you can also match up hunt because of his size. You can also post him up. And so I'm interested to see how they evolve the post-up game. Does that get him easier looks? Does that force doubles? How do teams react, respond? Can he kind of evolve in a LeBron-ish way to where I'm going to do this and just read what you guys do? I mean, there's a stretch in Cleveland where it was just LeBron posts up and stuff happens. And you spent 10 minutes in an edit just going over all the post-ups and what they were trying to do. So how does he develop in that portion of it will probably be the key for me.
I got you. I would say, is there a second? Because as you were going through kind of your criteria for the perfect second fiddle, like the first name that came to mind as far as like a star type that could potentially be available later, like it's Bradley Beal. Seems to be the kind of guy that can be a pressure point, has experience working off the ball as well. He doesn't have to have 25, 30 shots to put your defense in a bind. But, I mean, then you get into the asset game, like how do you get him? That's a whole thing. Like, I don't think that he's super attainable. But like,
you pulled the Steve. You had the idea that doesn't make... Because technically, that'd be perfect. Hey, I'll chill. You can run off four screens real quick.
And so, like, that is available. And again, like, talked about earlier, like I like Jalen Brunson alongside Luka. Do I think? I think he's a good second fiddle. I don't think he's the perfect second fiddle. So if you want to quibble about that, that's fine. As far as the heliocentric approach, like, I don't super mind it from Luka because he does operate in all three levels. And so he obviously can get to a step back or the sidestep whenever he wants. He's an incredible driver. You mentioned the mismatch hunting. He can get downhill against smaller guys. He can post up smaller guys and operate from the mid-range area. So, like, that doesn't bother me. If there's a tweak that needs to be made, I think it's just you can space the floor around one guy without it being space around the one guy and stand still. And I think that's one thing where I point to is like, okay, if you're going to post up Luka or if you're going to let him mismatch hunt, you can still occupy the weak side with something. Like, you can still have a pin in going on somewhere. You can have an exit. Like, Dallas already does with this with some of their pick and rolls, where they'll have some kind of high pick and roll, whether it's Spain or whatever, and they'll have an exit screen on the other side. And it's like, okay, so it's still Luka making all the decisions. It's still Luka ball dominant. But you're having to deal with Luka, the guy he's running the screen with, and this stuff on the weak side because they have shooters over here doing stuff. So you can't even help that way. And I think if they're able to tap into more of that kind of stuff, then, like, you look at Luka's usage rate in the playoffs, like, I think it's over 40. And it's like, oh, wow, that doesn't look great. But if you do enough off the ball and you get the production, because we did just have this stretch during the Western Conference Finals where Maxi Kleber didn't make shots for most of the series. Reggie Bullock was doing incredible work on the defensive end and still was needed to make five threes. Like, that wasn't great for them. But as far as the system itself, if you can incorporate a little bit more movement off the ball, it doesn't even have to be Warriors-esque in a whole bunch of post blitz and stuff. Like, just have some way to occupy helpers more consistently. Because that was kind of what stood out for me in this game five. Where Spencer Dinwiddie was getting downhill or Luka was getting downhill, but it's they got the mismatch and nobody moved. And so you could help a little bit more comfortably than I would like. So I don't think you have to go full scale, I guess, to use like the MJ analogy to where he was kind of ball dominant, then he went to the triangle. You don't have to do that for Luka, I don't think, but just incorporate a little bit more off the ball. I think that's where I see it anyway.
All right. Actually, I have one more question for you. I think this was a fun one. I saw. I don't have the password, but I'm gonna rip up the show sheet still.
Okay. What you got?
I think it was from Alec. He was asking, "Do you think other teams that have had a philosophy of offense over everything will react to four very good defensive teams making the conference finals? How do quasi contenders like Denver, Atlanta address this going forward?" What do you think about that? This feels like your ministry.
Like, I would hope so. Like, defense, and in particular, like, defensive versatility, I feel like is very important. And so, for Atlanta, I lamented their defense all season long. Between Clint Capella not being right for most of the year, slash not being available, DeAndre Hunter not being available, and then just the general, what are y'all doing off the what's happening with these rotations? Why can y'all not nail them the way that y'all were nailing them in the second half of last season? I think that should behoove them to improve the defensive personnel. Because, like, with a team like Denver, Jokic guarantees you a top five offense if he's healthy. Or he guarantees you a top 10 offense if he's healthy. Trae Young guarantees you a top 10 offense if he's healthy. That doesn't mean you give Trae Young, it's Trae Young and four non-shooters that can only play defense. Like, you don't want to do that to him. Because that's going to pose problems in the postseason as well. But, like, in general, I think if you have someone that can control that much of your offense, generate that much goodness for themselves and for others, you have more of a margin for error to lean towards some defense-only guy. I mean, like, the thing with Denver, like, they've played plenty of, over the last 2-3 years, they played plenty of non-shooters that can cut and defend because Luka is just the best passer to guys cutting in the league. Like, you can configure that and then get the benefit on the other end. Those guys couldn't play with, not to slander Bradley Beal, but like it's a different thing if they're playing alongside Bradley Beal. Like the passing reads aren't going to be the same. And that cramps the offense, that makes that worse. And you're playing more in transition because you're missing shots. So I think for that, yeah, I'd like to see some of these offense heavy teams, particularly in Atlanta, like lean more into the defensive end. Because ultimately, if you can't get stops, it doesn't really matter if Trey's dropping 30 and 12.
All this talking, now you're all defense guy. This is hilarious. I boy, I tell you, this is just the more you do this pod, the more I learn.
What does that mean?
Defense wins championships. I don't think that it will change a team's philosophy, but it should change, if you're in the front office, the understanding of what you need to make the run. You need to have the lineup versatility. You need to have the personnel to be able to execute whatever the vision is. You need to be able to have a team that can do multiple things. You don't want to just, the days of just being a drop team or just being this team.
Yeah, you can't do that.
Are done in the playoffs. You have to be able to do multiple things. So you've got to build a team with that kind of mindset that, hey, all right, we may be weak at this position with our starting lineup. So let's build wings around it. 3-D people around that. You know, we have a small guard. Do we have the rest of the activity that can make up for it? If our big isn't the best in coverage, do we have people who can navigate screens to help out? Those kind of things to me is where my mind goes as far as the philosophy team building wise goes.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, if you don't have defensive versatility, if you don't have lineup versatility, you're just kind of putting a roof over your head. Now, you don't know when your head's going to bump up against it, but eventually you will. And so you got to be able to navigate the regular season and build and have different things in the arsenal.
I'm with you. While we're on basketball philosophy, let's go into this question from Bennett, who asked, if you were a GM, would you favor the two stars plus depth approach or three stars plus, he said scrubs, but I'm taking it as like minimum contract guys.
I don't know that. Well, I mean, back to that point, I don't think the pure big three works these days unless you really have hit the margins with the people you add around it. Like, you've got to have the pieces. Like, the Brooklyn team from last year was built a lot more towards their big three and making a run, just missing a couple pieces, than this year's was. So you're not necessarily showing up to the dance with three. It's going to give you a shot, but if you run into the wrong matchup, if you don't have the right pieces around it, you know, you better have the people that, A, blend your top stars, and B, can hold up against other teams.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to run into the issue where, okay, we got the offensive part down, but now the defense, or vice versa. For me, I like two stars plus depth. Get your two pressure points, have pieces around them that complement them, that can shape and play together in different roles, different ways, and you can build and play out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Talent is talent, don't get me wrong. And every team, no matter what they say, is fighting to add and get more talent. So all of the culture development talk, that's fantastic. That's all to make sure we get to a point where we can take that to the bank and hand it over and receive talent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you do with that is what you do with that. But give me the depth. I like depth.
I'm with you. Like, one, this is a really good question. It's something that I've thought quite a bit about throughout this season. Like, Brooklyn has been kind of the easy example over the last couple of seasons because they cashed in basically all their chips to bring in. You get Kevin Durant, you get Kyrie Irving, you trade for James Harden. It's like, all right, this is what you have. This is, one, just an incredible bunch of offensive talent that you can't really scheme for comfortably. And so just having that kind of margin for error, like, hey, if our defense isn't great, that's cool. We have two of the best half-court scorers. We have three of the best half-court scorers the NBA has ever seen as a buffer. And just in general, having three players of that caliber of talent, if a guy gets hurt, the theory goes, like, okay, this guy can take on more usage now. And that's fine. I guess my kind of cop-out answer is, like, I'm fine with three stars depending on which organization has those three stars.
Oh, who are you slandering?
I don't even think it's slander. It's more so, like, I look at
You're giving Portland props. I see you.
But no, I look at like what Miami has been able to do in terms of finding guys second round slash undrafted slash G League. Like they're able to churn out these positive players on the margins pretty consistently. And so if they were able to build a big three, I would have more of a faith level in, okay, the talent is the talent. So that already puts them at a level. But also I trust that they're going to be able to find a Gabe Vincent, a Max Strus, those guys to kind of build out around the margins, more so than another team that may get three stars and, okay, how are they building this? A la the Los Angeles Lakers. Like they did not, they weren't able to get the off-ball movers, the shooters, the right blend of defenders. Like it's just a different organizational faith that I have. And so like I think ultimately I'm get three stars if you can get them. But it comes with the caveat like, hey, I need to see who's getting these guys.
Well, I mean, if your team get, I mean, I'm never going to say don't get the three stars, but you got to be prepared to handle what goes with it.
That's kind of where, man, I hope that doesn't count as too much of a cop out, but like, that's where
it does. It does.
Oh, well, all right. Well, I'll just have to take that L. That's fine.
Well, a lot of hat there.
No hat boy. All right. Let's get into some WNBA questions that we received before we close this pod out. First one comes from Khatija, who asked, the Dream and Ryan Howard have been super fun to watch this season. What are some things that you think we need to see from them to ensure they're able to find success as the season progresses?
I mean, it's just going to be how they handle the early success. As more film is out on them, can they generate the same kind of pressure? Offensively, we've seen when the ball is moving, when they get dribble penetration, when they're able to drive and kick. But we've also seen teams start to dig in a little bit more against those actions. And so they're going to have to find a way to execute when the easies aren't there. Execute in the half court. Defensively, find a way when one person has it going. Maybe you're not able to lock in as much team defensively. The activity isn't working as much. You know, for me, it was watching a couple of possessions when Elena Deladon was just going on work. And it was like, oh, it's a little bit different for y'all.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily in a bad way, but yeah, that's a different challenge. And as the season progresses, more teams are going to be ready for them. You know, it's difficult to continue to be a surprise. So how do they handle that going forward? And can they continue to create good looks for Howard, use that versatility to their advantage, or are they going to lean on the talent a little bit? That'll be interesting for me to watch.
Okay. I would say on that for one, like, the defense is kind of where I key in the most with them. Like, one, they just have to keep up their activity level, be prepared to help. You hit on most of what I was going to say, so I'm not going to rehash all of that. But I look at just generally, like, how's the defense going to look? How locked in are they going to be from a help perspective? And I think it's even more important. One, they're just a young team. But two, Cheyenne Parker has been great for them at the five, but she's more comfortable at the four. Like, they don't have the big 6'5", 6'6", center that they can throw at a Liz Cambage when she comes through. Though that first matchup was a whole nother. They took advantage of Liz on the other end. But like in general, like they don't have the big body. They can say, all right, just defend Asia, defend Jonquel, defend Liz, et cetera, et cetera. So like once they get those kind of matchups, or when you get the versatile five, like EDD's been playing the five a lot this season. How can you key in on that and maintain your defensive principles? So just keep an eye on how they navigate skilled front court players as they grow. And then on the offensive end, it's more so just what is the Tiffany Haynes dynamic really going to look like as the season goes on? And like, I don't even mean it from like an ego thing. Cause like, I think they're going to be fine. Like her and Ryan Howard are probably going to mesh together, but I just want to see what that does to the rest of the ego. Like what does that do with Erica Wheeler's aggression? What kind of looks will Ryan Howard get with Cheyenne Parker? Just the ability to pick and pop or pick and roll, the occasional post up. Like, are her looks going to be different now with Tiffany Hayes when she's back in the fold full time? So, just that's mostly what I'm looking at. Just synergy on both ends, I think, is kind of where I'm at with Atlanta. Let's get into this question from Patrick, since we're already talking about the Mystics. You've talked about it briefly, but what do you think of the Elena Deladon and Shakira Austin minutes together for the Mystics?
I love it. I think that is a great duo, especially I think they just complement each other very well, and you can use them in different ways. You know, so you can use, obviously we know what EDD brings to the table, but you can use Austin as a screener in space. You can go with EDD as a screener, you know, with Shakira Austin snaking around the basket. Both of them can post up. Both of them can attack and drive. You can even use them together if you wanted to and have Austin screen. And now EDD goes to a post up or an ISO or however you want to go with it. So I think together, their skill set works. And Shakira Austin kind of has that energy and work ethic that just really complements what EDD brings to the table offensively. But I like them together as a duo because of that. It just doesn't feel like they get in each other's way. Mm-hmm. And it feels like they just help boost a Mystics offense that sometimes can get in some trouble in the half court.
I'm with you. Like, they're both incredibly skilled. And just kind of hammer home what they can do. Like, Shakira Austin's also a very good passer already at the five. And that just opens up a wealth of things they can do in the half court if you're worried about spacing concerns at all. Quick stat while we're here. They played 71 minutes together, a 110.9 offensive rating and 85 defensive rating right now. Nearly a plus 26 net rating in 71 minutes. So not only has it looked good, it's definitely working statistically. Also, just we talked about this early in the season. Like, EDD at the five is going to bring some defensive questions. To her credit, she has fought very hard. She has looked solid defensively this year. Shakira Austin also helps. Just her general activity level, has the athleticism to play a little bit higher in screens if necessary, but also she just helps on the rebounding. And so if you get enough of that, if they're able to complement each other on the defensive end, and they already look like a natural fit offensively, despite them really, I guess, at their best, both being fives, honestly, but they're skilled enough to make that work, and then they're complementing each other on the other end. Like, I don't see a reason why it wouldn't work. And this is year one of Shakira Austin. So if she develops more of a jumper, if she gets more comfortable facing up and driving, like, it just makes Washington's offense even more dynamic. So I've liked it so far. This question from Brian, who asks, are you surprised that Kennedy Carter hasn't played that much for the Sparks thus far? She seems like she'd be well-suited to provide some much-needed scoring punch. It was nice to see her have a solid outing recently. But beyond that, it has been a little bit of a shock to me. Which now in hindsight, I guess I should have seen that the fit would have been a little bit wonky. The spacing hasn't been great for the Sparks. And we've talked about this on an early episode when we had Mark Schindler on. Just the general like tempo and flow of the half-court offense for the Sparks hasn't really been there consistently. And that hurts someone like Kennedy, who ultimately she wants the ball in her hands. She kind of wants to roll it out. She wants to drive and pick and roll and kind of get busy that way. You can't really do that with the spacing concerns the Sparks have had, while also trying to work in, like, I'm still wondering, like, what the Kennedy-Liz minutes are going to look like as that sample grows. Because they're just two entirely different players. And so there's just a lot working against her. And then you get into the general backcourt. Like, if she's playing with Lexi Brown, Lexi is a ridiculous point of attack defender, very good shooter, but also they're both, like, 5'8", 5'9". And so that poses some side concerns in the backcourt. It's kind of a similar thing with Jordan Canada, who isn't the shooter that Lexi Brown is, but a better driver, better playmaker, but they're still small. And if you do have Canada in instead of Lexi Brown, like, you're able to help off of Jordan Canada on the perimeter. That hurts some of the Kennedy drives. So I think for now, it's trying to figure out how to incorporate her into the fold, period, because she's new on the team, obviously. And then it's also, how do we incorporate her in lineups that can maximize what she does without taking things off the plate for everyone else? And it's just been a weird mix so far.
Well, I think she's just taking the brunt of the Sparks trying to find their way. Because you mentioned the lineups. One, for me, just with their general offensive philosophy right now, feels like a lot of elbow action. And for someone who is very good with the ball in their hands, makes it a little trickier to find a rhythm. Mm-hmm. If you're spending time cutting, maybe not getting the handoffs, maybe it's post up, There's not a real rhythm or feel there at times. You can tell sometimes, you know, she's running offense. Sometimes she's creating a bucket for herself. But it doesn't, you know, there's not necessarily a flow to win. I guess I put it, it never rarely feels like it's run something for her. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You know, she's playing with Sykes. Sykes is probably going to initiate. Now you're off ball. Do you get it? Do you not? And then I think just overall, the Sparks trying to find their way, trying to find their lineups. It's hard when it's your turn, my turn, but also we're running different things at different times. So, you know, I might get a pick and roll now, but that might be my one pick and roll for the next 2 minutes. So
slightly different.
It's up to the Sparks to kind of find it. I think Katie Lou being back helps them at least finding a balance. Mm-hmm. But I wonder how much Canada's emergence maybe took a hit in that regards. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can see. Like, it's just, it's a lot of conflicting talent. I think I will say, like, I think it's going to look a little bit different as we get into mid-June, July. Like, I think they've been it won't surprise me if we have the Sparks are 13-4 in their last 17 games stretch from them. If they're able to get the lineups together and they're able to stay healthy. But right now, it's just a lot working against each other right now. It's just unnatural for everyone right now.
Yeah, it's not a talent issue at all. They have a bunch of talent. It's just how are they going to blend the pieces together? And I think once they find that rhythm, they'll probably look different as the season goes on. But they're going to have to work at it, you know, because, again, if I bring it up and the play's a post-up and then next time I'm sitting in the corner and now the next time I'm coming for a handoff, it's just tough to get a rhythm, especially when you're a scorer.
Yeah. All right, let's move to Tristan, who has three questions for us. One, with how well the Aces have played, what do you think the bigger change over the last year is? Not having Liz Cambage and drop or the new offensive system?
This is your ministry, buddy.
Yeah, like while it would be, I'm tempted to go with Liz just because, like, aesthetically, that just bothers me. Like, you know, my whole thing on, like, deep drops without much scheme versatility elsewhere. I do think it's the offense is just so much more. It's so much more open. Just the commitment and the general embracing of the three-point shot, as simple as that is. It has opened up and unlocked multiple players at this point. You've talked about Kelsey Plum already on our prior episodes and in watch parties. She is unlocked. She's able to pull off a pick and roll. She's able to pull in transition. They are running all kinds of wizardry off the ball for her to get her threes. And she is shooting over contest. She's comfortable. She's confident. And she's torching the Nets right now. But having her willing to shoot threes, Asia Wilson just went 2-4 from three against the Sparks, which lit my heart on fire. But her having the confidence and having the willingness to take those shots, that's going to be big moving forward, I feel like. But having that general spacing, having that general willingness, that's also unlocked Jackie Young. She's able to pretty much eat whenever she wants to in a mid-range area. She's able to get downhill a little bit easier with the way De'Erica Hamby is used. They'll space her weak side corner. Like, she can knock down shots. She's not treated as a shooter. But she can do that, also flow into handoffs, kind of Draymond-esque. If teams help too far off of her, that also opens up drives for her. They call her big guard for a reason. She can get downhill. So I think just that is a bigger thing than Liz in the drop. Like, that annoyed me, but the Aces were still a good defense last year. They were still a good offense last year. But I think this just gives them a little bit more. The Aces aren't losing the numbers game in the way that they were last season.
It's hard to argue against that. It's interesting to hear you become 3-point man, but it's funny. I guess my counter would just be, I still love the defensive versatility. Mm-hmm. Just being able to do that many different things is something that you can build on throughout the season. So you can rely on that if maybe the threes aren't falling or the offense bogs down in the half court. You still have your defense to lean on. But just having that dual threat for me is this the option. So yeah, I went ahead and said just yes to that question.
That's fair. That's fair. Well, I got the Aces question. This question will be for you. Can the Liberty get back on track, or are we looking at another doomed season?
It's not looking great right now for the Liberty. Liberty season not looking ideal, but I don't think it's over yet. The thing for them is they're going to have to just get good at one thing. Mm-hmm. So the defense is either going to have to get better, or the offense is going to have to get better. I'm leaning on the offense having to get better because of the defense. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can't have the pace, find the pace, have the flow, and shoot 9-for-32 from three against Minnesota and hope for success. It's going to be, can you find the blend? Can you get Sabrina unlocked in a sense with how teams are guarding her? I mean, offensively, process-wise, even their last game, 28 made field goals, 24 assists, got the right idea. The issue is 28-for-71. So if you're not scoring and now you're having to continue to defend all the time, it's a tough blend for them. So for me, it's, hey, find a way to unlock yourself offensively, figure it out defensively, and see if you can get it going from there. But if you're going to alternate between really bad defensive game and really bad offensive game, and then sometimes both happens, it will indeed be a long season.
And it has been one to this point.
Okay. All right, man.
Oh, man. All right. Last one, a little bit off the beaten path. Also from Tristan. Are you guys going to look up north and check out any of the CEBL, the Canada Elite Basketball League? Joel Anthony is the GM for the Montreal club, and they're using the Elam ending. Consider me intrigued.
Consider Why? Because the ending or Joel Anthony?
Yes. I had a Warden joke. I'm not going to make it. It's fine.
Nah, go ahead, man. Get it in there.
The only one we respect on this podcast, but
not the mechanic.
We're going to investigate the Dwayne Dedman hate at some point, but it's fine. But no, I'm down to check it out. Got to see what old Joel's doing. Will you be checking out the CEBL? This is a freebie.
What's up?
This is come on. This is how you earn some points with our fans in Canada.
Hello.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Dunker Spot. If you have not already, please subscribe to us. We are on Apple, Spotify, Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your pods. You can find us. You can find me on Twitter at NikaiasNBA. You can find Steve on Twitter at SteveJones20. If you have not already, please join the Dunker Spot community on Twitter so you can have some great discussions with us, get in on the banter, get in on jokes, watch some games with us, have some fun. And with that, we'll catch you next week.
Go Niagara.